Paper 1, Section 2, Old Single Column, page 23. Let's see. I don't think we need any preface to this. Let's just jump right in. We're working our way into paper 1 here and just taking it one little beginning step at a time. And we've already sort of seeded that last week when we started it up. You know, you start with very basic things like the Father's name, and then next we do the reality of God, the whole issue of, you know, is he the opiate of the masses, or is he real? And of course, then you can even go beyond, is he a he? And in our meditation, was that he or she? That was she. All right, let's do it.
The reality of God. God is primal reality in the spirit world. God is the source of truth in the mind spheres. God overshadows all throughout the material realms. To all created intelligences, God is a personality. And to the universe of universes, he is the first source and center of eternal reality. God is neither man-like nor machine-like. The first Father is universal spirit, eternal truth, infinite reality, and Father personality.
All right. Notice how they put that bigger break there? So let's figure out what they want us to have in this first paragraph. In the middle there, to all created intelligences, God is a personality, and to the universe of universes, he is the first source and center of eternal reality. That should remind you of the first sentence in the paper. Universal Father is the God of all creation, the first source and center of all things and beings. Okay, so they're reiterating that. Now, why exactly? What's the point? You have that sandwiched between two sequences. Did you notice that? How you had an initial sequence of things and then the closing sequence. Reflect on the parallel there. Okay, so just that, you know, to all created intelligences, God is a personality. That facet of the Father, what do we call that facet of the Father? Personality circuit. That would be the universal Father. Okay? That's the universal Father. Okay? Might even be the title of the paper. Okay? Universal Father. So think about, you know, when you're thinking in the infinite eternal ellipse, what are they invoking with, you know, both that first sentence in the paper and then here again? Okay, you know, here's the circuit of the Father, second one from the inside there. Okay, so there's the universal Father. And they're saying, okay, that's the personality face that's engaging you. And then notice how they word that. And then they bring up the first source and center of eternal reality. So they're giving this initial concept of, okay, there's this personality face that's put forward, and then behind that is the reality foundation of that very personal face. Okay, behind the universal Father is the first source and the first center. Okay. Now, when they open it up there, God is primal reality in the spirit world, source of truth in the mind spheres, and overshadows all throughout the material realms. Okay, that's all, you know, reality statements. You know, it's obviously spirit, mind, and matter. You know, the threefold actuality. Spirit, mind, and matter. And then they were bringing in the personality after that. Okay, what that first part is about is the first source and center. Like we've mentioned a few times recently, it's beyond the scope of what you know, we can do in this class to get into what's really graduate level, you know, unraveling of the co-infinite and the infinite and what have you. But what they're pointing to there is within the nature, you know, within the nature of the first source and center, that fact, and you figure out exactly what that fact is, or it's not just a name, but exactly what that fact is, within that you can understand how there's an aspect of it that's the primal reality of the spirit world, you know, sort of behind the spirit world, the source of truth in the mind spheres, and then it overshadows all throughout the material realm. So those three things, I think, are that threefold actuality within the first source and center. Okay, and so on the one side, you know, sort of within, you know, really, really behind, you've got that, and then they give you the two sentences I read first, and then they give you the third. That's, you take what's within the first source and center, and you reflect it without. Okay, and so what happens when you reflect that without? And we've talked about this many times in terms of, you know, that the first source aspect of the first source and center is very much tied to the universal father. I mean, this is the reservoir of all will. You individuate that, you know, make an individuation of that will as personality, and it's bestowed by the universal father. Those two are very intimately linked. I mean, this is sort of the quiver for the arrows of personality that the father delivers. He just reaches back and individuates some will and bestows it. Okay, so in terms of aspects of the first source and center, that very, you know, out front first source part is very tied to the universal father. You know, the personality that they brought in the middle part. Yeah. Then so when you look and you see the first father is universal spirit, eternal truth, infinite reality, and father personality. Okay, see, so father personality, that's the universal father. And that's, you know, an expression of what's within the reservoir of will. Without is the father personality, universal father. So those other three are going to be these other three facets of the father that are then reflections of what was within, without. Okay, let's do them in... you know, in a mixed up order, so I can follow it around the chart here instead of in the spirit, mind, matter order that they have it listed. Because I move out from the universal father, you know, what does it say after that first sentence and at the beginning of the paper? First. Yeah, first thing of God is a creator, then as a controller, and lastly is an infinite upholder. A creator, the universal creator, a controller, the universal controller, and lastly the infinite upholder. Okay. So, the universal creator part, that's the eternal truth. That's the expression without. Now, how can you just sort of immediately have an appreciation without going into any deep details? How can you give some sense that that facet of the Father, the universal creator, is tied to eternal truth? The universal creator is the aspect of the Father that's combining with the second source and center as the coordinate creator, to give rise to a creator son. Okay? And a creator son, after his seventh bestowal, bestows what? Spirit of truth. Well, that didn't take me much stepping to see an immediate linkage. Okay? So that's that truth that's, you know, that's so intimately tied to a creator son, you just follow it back. Okay? It's tied, you know, to the eternal truth of the universal creator. Let's see, how about infinite reality? Okay, that's the universal controller. Why? Easy way to begin to appreciate that, we've talked about many times, and you're just thinking from an individuality viewpoint, you have this relationship between the universal father and the eternal son, that personal relationship. And on the other hand, you have the non-personal relationship between the Isle of Paradise and not the Universal Father, the Universal Controller. So Universal Father, Eternal Son, Universal Controller, Paradise Isle. Okay? If you think of the Universal Controller, that facet of the Father is really being the originator of the Isle of Paradise, you know, the initiator of the Isle of Paradise. And if the Isle of Paradise is the center of infinity, something is going to initiate the center of infinity. That something would have to be an infinite reality. How could it possibly embrace infinity and form its center if it wasn't an infinite reality? Okay. So that infinite reality, that's the universal controller that they're referring to there. And then one we're going to talk about quite a bit tonight, the universal spirit. Okay, there's only one left. You know that's got to be the infinite upholder. Okay, now why? Why can you immediately begin to appreciate that? From the unity viewpoint, it's called the infinite upholder. From the individuality viewpoint, what's the name of that? The
universal
absolute. The universal absolute. Universal spirit. Very purposely using that adjective to link it like that. Now, why spirit? Why would you think of that as spirit? Well, we've already figured out a very easy way to understand that, why you would use the word spirit in relationship to the infinite upholder. The Father has two reservoirs, two facets that have the adjective infinite, the infinite one and the infinite upholder. That means the Father bestows two things out of those reservoirs. We know he bestows personality out of the infinite one, that reservoir. We just talked about that. He only bestows one other thing. It's got to be out of the other reservoir. It's got to be a fragment out of the infinite upholder reservoir. As a thought adjuster comes from that other reservoir. We call the thought adjuster, you know, influencing your mind, a pure spirit. Okay? All right, so that's what they're getting at. Those simple little initial connections. Like I said, when you take your understanding of deity, you know, to a complete level, you flesh everything all the way up, you know, through the co-absolute, the absolute, the co-infinite, and the infinite, you can, you know, even appreciate the details on the backside there. You know, why you would call an aspect of it the primal reality of the spirit world, etc. So that's what they're getting at there. So the very first thing that they're doing has all of that depth in it. Once you have, you know, begun to understand total deity, you know, and the full nature of the Father with all six facets of the Father in play in your understanding. So the first thing they give is a man's subjective notions of the Father. No, it's a full-blown objective statement is the first thing they get. So that first paragraph is saying, okay, there is a very definitive objective fact. And if you're, you know, if you're beyond the first reading of the book, if you're, you know, into a fair depth of understanding, you really can appreciate how they're driving that point home. I mean, it's objective in a complex way with all kinds of detail that you can understand. Okay, so that's the first. That's what the point of that first paragraph is, the objective reality of God. So you can obviously guess what the next paragraph is going to be. It's going to be subjective. So what do they say about subjective?
The eternal God is infinitely more than reality idealized or the universe personalized. God is not simply the supreme desire of man, the mortal quest objectified. Neither is God merely a concept, the power potential of righteousness. The universal Father is not a synonym for nature, neither is he natural law personified. God is a transcendent reality, not merely man's traditional concept of supreme values. God is not a psychological focalization of spiritual meanings, neither is he the noblest work of man. God may be any and all of these concepts in the minds of men, but he is more. He is a saving person and a loving father to all who enjoy spiritual peace on earth and who crave to experience personality survival in death.
Okay, the main thing in that paragraph relative to the rest of the book, there's a number of places, you know, as you get familiar with the whole book, where they have a paragraph like that, where they rattle off all of, you know, a whole list of subjective notions that humans have or have had about God. You know, and this whole notion of trying to take the initial assumption that all there is what you can conceive from a bottom-up viewpoint, and so the best God could be is some extrapolation of myself or some idealism of myself or some idealism I conceive within myself, whatever. But you're just trying to exalt it as far as you can, and we call that God. You know, no, the reality of God is top down. That sentence we just constructed was very, or that first paragraph that we just unraveled was very top down. It went from the toppest of the top, what's really inside the first source and center, you know, and then begins to give face and then rolls itself out to engage, you know, the infinite reality. Okay, that's the reality of God is very much top down. And they're telling you the first challenge that you're confronted with is to flip the entire history of reflections on God 180 degrees. You've got to begin to bring in a true top-down viewpoint, a unity viewpoint, instead of just exaltations of the individuality viewpoint. Especially because you're going to have a lot of difficulty ending up with a personal God when you just try to exalt what's below. Because, you know, what you start with down below is matter, mind, and spirit, things. You know, and like they're saying, he's not any one of those things exalted or some process between those things exalted or anything like that. And the little bit, the noblest work of man. The whole quote is, an honest God's, you know, God is, an honest God's the noblest work of man. That was by Samuel Butler, who was a British author, and would have been very ripe in a lot of people's minds back then, because it was first published in 1912, a collection of his notebook writings, and that line was in there, and it captured people's imagination back at the beginning of the 20th century. You know, so they're actually grabbing a hold of that. It's obvious why they did. It's just a nice little pithy statement of sort of any kind of exaltation. Whatever you think is the noblest work of man, and exalt it, and that's God. No, you know. Remember what all the six Sangic races did. Each of the Sangic races took what the consciousness that they have because of the adjutant that they favor, and they exalted that into their name for God. You know, so when you favor the primary spirit adjutant, the sixth adjutant, the name for God is going to be the Great Spirit. You're going to exalt that consciousness into your name for God. Et cetera. You can go through all of them like that. So that's the whole point. There, it's no matter how noble the noble thing might be, even if it's sort of the pinnacle of your Sangic consciousness in nobility, it's still not God. Okay, that's just a shadow cast down from above. You know, that's you're calling the shadow God. You know, there's a reality of God. You know, and he's none of the shadows that he casts, no matter how substantive those shadows are. Because, of course, they are. They're kind of like holodeck shadows. They're substantive, okay? They're not wisps, you know? They're things like this. You know, this is really solid. You know, but God is not the absolute anchor of this matter. God is behind the absolute anchor of this matter. God is behind the Isle of Paradise, as the universal controller, you know, et cetera. Go through anything like that. Yeah.
So, well, it just dawned on me, maybe this book is challenging us to go beyond the racial concepts of God.
Absolutely.
And,
ethnic,
and
racial.
Come to a unified that is something the whole planet can look to.
Yeah,
not just particular countries or races or tendencies of people.
We've talked about that many times. I mean, there's a very powerful notion threaded in the founding of this nation, that we're not a nation of a certain ethnic group or a certain race or a certain region on the globe. You know, we're going to come together as one nation under a high concept. We're one nation under God. You know, that's what we should, you know, we're attempting to see ourselves as having in common an objective God, not a subjective God that reflects our racial differences, but we've challenged ourselves to rise above our initial subjective genetic starting point. And when we all do that, we discover we share the recognition of God in common, because we're all using one Holy Spirit, the Holy Spirit, and the recognition of the one God through it. It's fostering all that, you know. Putting that right up front. All right, let's get a little more here.
The actuality of the existence of God is demonstrated in human experience by the indwelling of the divine presence, the spirit monitor sent from paradise to live in the mortal mind of man and there to assist in evolving the immortal soul of eternal survival. The presence of this divine adjuster in the human mind is disclosed by three experiential phenomena. 1. The intellectual capacity for knowing God, God consciousness. 2. The spiritual urge to find God, God seeking. 3. The personality craving to be like God, the wholehearted desire to do the Father's will.
Okay. Now, one little aside, I want you to notice, again, always be challenging yourself to see the book in a holistic fashion. When you see this intellectual, spiritual, personal, you should immediately think of a list of three things like that up towards the beginning of the adjuster papers. In paper 108, section 1, if you want to just flip there, it's old single column 1186, and we're not going to go through them, but just I want to foster this, you know, recognition of parallels, because they're, you know, endless in the book. Remember when they're talking, remember the title of that is Selection and Assignment. It's all about that notion of how does an adjuster select, and they give this list of three that they look at the intellectual capacity, the spiritual perception, and the combined intellectual and spiritual powers, and personal. That's what, you know, personality is what can combine, okay? So what they're reminding you of here, if you've read the adjuster papers and you come back here, you're going, oh, okay, those three very basic domains that the adjuster looked at and carefully assessed you relative to when your adjuster chose you, not surprisingly, in the same threefold fashion, the presence of that adjuster is going to greatly foster, leverage, catalyze what's going on in those three domains. Okay. Think about this parallel here that we always bring up when we're talking about matter, mind, spirit, personality. If you have a moving mind, we call that progressing. You know, you have a progressing mind, and you have a perfecting spirit and a harmonizing personal character. Progressing, perfecting, harmonizing. Okay, remember right at the very end of the foreword, they gave that little definition of God consciousness? And they use the word progressing in that. So here we are. See, intellectual capacity, progressing mind, and there's God consciousness again. See, they're tying those together. Now, what's the differential? When you say the presence of this divine adjuster in the human mind is disclosed by three experiential phenomena. Okay, in what way? Now, if I don't have Pentecost, if I don't have the universal bestowal of the Spirit of Truth and thought adjusters, let's say all I have is the Holy Spirit. I mean, I have the third cosmic intuition. I have spiritual insight. I have the ability to recognize the fact of God. Isn't that God consciousness? Yes, that's beginning God consciousness. The recognition of the fact of God. You know about God through the third cosmic intuition. But if you actually put a fragment of that God within your mind that you can bump into within your mind, you're not just knowing about God, you actually know God as an experiential fact. You've touched a fragment of that God in your mind. So that's what, see, it doesn't say the intellectual capacity for knowing about God, for knowing God experientially, literally. Okay, taking God consciousness to a whole new level. Okay? Not something that you see, no matter how clearly, in front of you, and you know about it, you actually feel it, experience it. The other one, okay, perfectibility. You're God the Father seeking because of the mandate. Be you perfect even as I am perfect. God seeking, be you perfect, perfecting spirit. Okay? And it's gone beyond just, you see this incredible light, with your third cosmic intuition, and you're drawn to the light, yes. But this is more than that. This is an urge. Because when you put that fragment of God within your mind, lock it onto your mind, spirit gravity has a hold of that spirit fragment, and spirit gravity is pulling that spirit fragment. And if that spirit fragment is locked onto your mind, then it's pulling your mind. You're literally being urged, into the God-seeking mode, taking God-seeking to a whole new level, taking it beyond, something that you're behind the impulse. You're now on the escalator, and it's going up, or the elevator, whichever way you want to see it. Whether you want to see, why would you see it both ways? God the sevenfold is kind of like a staircase, so you can see it as an escalator. He's pulling you up that staircase. When we think of the adjuster as this rod, this finger of God that's reached down and inserted into your mind, and the more you grab a hold of that, you just move up that elevator shaft. That literal spirit gravity.
Yeah.
Why would it be then, like everybody, well, me anyway, always have been searching for God and feeling like I know God. Mm-hmm. Other people, they'll start with that same, instinct to go to God or to seek for God, and then they don't find him or they don't continue to look for him. I don't understand that. They have intellectual capacity. Why wouldn't they continue to crave?
They don't. See, you're making an assumption there. And we're going to talk about that, not the next section, but the section after that, if I remember right. Remember, we've talked about there's two things. I mean, it's one thing for me to have spiritualize to see the light. But I'm a very finite fact, and I can only sort of self-motivate myself so far. What I really need is to be grabbed a hold of. Well, if in order for God to grab a hold of you, you have to have capacity. You may be pint-sized, and he can grab you with a pint of urge, but a pint is going to run out. It's like, well, then he'll give me a quart. No, he won't. Not if you only have a pint-sized capacity. Remember, there's two consecrations. That's why we bring this up all the time. You can consecrate your will to the perfect will of God the Father, but you have to consecrate your mind to the universal harmony. You have to consecrate your mind to God the Mother, who is a capacity-producing phenomenon. The Father's not a capacity-producing phenomenon. The Father doesn't have that capacity potential that he can actualize within you. She does. It's been given into her hands. She can grow you to a quart. Okay, and then the instant you're a quart, the Father is in there. But the Father, you know, remember, even the Spirit of Truth, I mean, they're very limited to the capacity. See, that? So that's why that's first. It's not just because you go mind, spirit, personality. I mean, there's a logical order here, too. You need to have the capacity first. And that's why, remember, they tell you that this relationship to the mothers dominates throughout the whole local universe. That, you know, through the local universe, you're trying to build up the capacity in order to be able to have the capacity for what's ahead of you in the super universe, and especially when you get to Havona. You need a vast capacity far beyond anything that you have right now. And so you need to take delight in cultivating a relationship with the capacity-producing potential of the mother. She needs to grow you.
A lot of our concepts of God originate from how we were raised, and our idea of God and concept of God comes from how we viewed our parents. Mm-hmm. A lot of the time, so if we have a negative connotation of who our parents are very dictator-ish or mm-hmm. over-controlling, then we tend to think of God in that way as well, so we don't want to have anything to do with it.
Yeah, and as the Universal Father is up there on the infinite level, he has to downstep that, you know, and that's why there's a whole hierarchy of fathers. And down in the first, you know, rung of that ladder of father likeness is your biologic father. You know, in the same way with the mother, biologic mother. Biologic father and the biologic mother are your first two ways of learning about God the Father and God the Mother. And if those are very confused or disrupted, then you've got that first challenge in front of you. I mean, it's one of the reasons why one of the parents has a very sort of very difficult to deny instinct built into them, so that there's a chance that at least there'll be womb, at least there'll be mother to start that child out, even if the father is immediately out of the picture or never in the picture. That mother at least can get you going until you can begin to engage the father reaching within from above, and you can begin to recognize father at higher notches. Well, you know, and therein comes the problem with the rebellion and default here. You know, that the father of the realm, the planetary father, that's Adam. Okay, well, we don't have Adam either. See, so if you don't have your biologic father, we don't have Adam right there in front of us in corporeal form to turn to. So we've got to, you know, if you don't have a good starting, father, you've got a real handicap to overcome. Because you can't get to perfection without both. You need both a full relationship to God the Mother and a full relationship to God the Father. And the extent to which you don't have that, you know, at the beginning, you're going to have to make up for that in some way. So, yeah, that whole hierarchy of the fathers is very important. Because obviously the next rung up, the system sovereign, is a little tough to get your hands on, you know, while you're still here. Now, and you don't have the planetary prince to say, yes, but I'm the direct representative of that system sovereign, and I can speak for him. So you don't even have a deputized, you know, next. So you got the first three fathers, you know, in arrears, you know, if you don't have that biologic father. Yeah.
What you're saying about capacity reminded me of the Beatitudes. Mm-hmm. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for they shall.
Yeah.
I don't remember that. I just reminded me of that. But one's talking about capacity, the other's talking about
coming. Right. You know, there's actual capacity to be filled. It's poor. It's empty. There is a capacity. You know, the difficult thing are those individuals who don't have teachable mind. You know, you're all given an initial capacity, and if you fill it with a bunch of very definitive isms, so that your mind is no longer teachable, you don't really have any effective capacity anymore. You have taught mind. You don't have teachable mind. You're not poor in spirit. You know, you're moving ever closer and closer to self-righteousness. The more you stay in that state of self-satisfaction, you know, you don't have the potential for the Father to reach you. Now, that's why humility and patience are so important as first steps. It's very important to ask yourself, do I have only taught mind? And it doesn't matter if you started out with a small amount that was teachable or a large amount which is teachable. If it's all taught, the difference is irrelevant now. You have no potential left. You just have taught mind. And taught mind cannot follow truth. No matter how much it might give lip service to following the truth, it's impossible for taught mind to follow truth. You know, you have to have teachable mind, because to take one step, you have to learn. You know, and if you think you've dotted the last I, then you can't take a step. It has to flow into you. Truth is a flow. It's not something you possess. It's like, I've taught myself truth. No, you haven't. You can't do that. You don't know what truth is if you think you've taught yourself truth. Truth is something you know, but you know it as a flow through you. You know you're an actual truth seeker, not just, you know, a truth seeker in name only, self-proclaimed name. You know, if every day, every week, whatever your pace is, you have left an old you behind. If your relationship to God just is head and shoulders beyond what it was last week, okay, now you're actually following truth. That's what it feels like to follow truth. You know, if you think that you've dotted an I and you now carry truth, no. The moment you concretize it, it ceases to be truth. It may have some factual character that you're holding on to, but that's going to be fleeting because the supreme march is on. And you know, so you have to strike step with the truth. You can't try to lock onto a fact or factualize truth.
One of the things that my husband said after he finished with seminary was that one of the things that was wrong with Christianity is that the Bible had a back cover.
Yeah, and does this book have a back cover to you? You know, do you start at the beginning and you get to the end, it's like, okay, I've read it. You know, if you think you've read it, then you think it's a revelation of fact, not a revelation of truth. And it says right up front, to reveal truth and coordinate essential knowledge. It's a revelation of truth. You know, so if you're following the truth, you cannot find the end of it, no matter how hard you try. Every time you pick it up, 12 new doors open. And you are getting really comfortable. You want the doors to geometrically grow. You want it so that you can see infinite doors that you haven't crossed the threshold of yet, and you're not afraid. That's what you're looking for, that sort of a state. To be comfortable with everything still open to you. You're teachable in every direction. You don't consider yourself completed in any direction at all. The moment that you think you are, you're done.
Sorry, what do you mean geometrically?
Geometrically, I mean, you know, I open 12 doors, you know, when I look, and then through each one of those doors, 12 more doors open, and through each of those 12 more, it grows exponentially, geometrically.
It looks so beautiful when you said that. I just pictured.
Let it open up all the way to infinity, you know. You know, you want it. You want to actually see it open up until there's an infinite vista. You know, all the walls are gone. It's all door now. And but you're not afraid. There's no vertigo. You don't feel like you're dangling on the edge of some infinite abyss of fear, you're fine with an infinite vista in front of you, because you know that underneath you is what we just read about, the infinite upholder. You can't fall. And that's what you want. And if you, you know, just don't ever think that you, so I think I've got an infinite vista. Of course you don't. You can only have a finite vista, you know? You know? So every time you think you've found the limits of infinity, think again. Find it, challenge yourself and make it bigger. You can always make it bigger. All right, let's, wait, one more thing. We got the third point. Yeah, we don't want to leave that. So how is the adjuster boosting this third one? You know, I don't need the adjuster to have a personality. You know, and there's going to be a personality craving. You know, you're going to have, you know, especially if you take delight in cultivating a full relationship with all three cosmic intuitions, so you begin to see all three notes of the chord, and you can actually begin to see the harmony of the three notes, you know, that you see in the three cosmic intuitions, you'll get a sense of harmony going there. But imagine how much that will be leveraged if a point of harmony is stuck into your mind. Because, you know, what do you actually engage experientially about that adjuster? Do you engage its existential core? Of course not. You engage the experiential nature that's wrapped around that existential core. The part that goes beyond the virgin adjuster, the core, the existential core. That's a mother-like harmony that's wrapped around that adjuster. It's a point of harmony stuck right in your mind. You know, and so if you ever have a question, well, what exactly does a harmonious chord look like in this regard? You've got this reference point right there. And so now, if you actually see, and that's a wholehearted, you know, we've talked about this, where is that adjuster? Is it, you know, when we look at it in the hourglass, you know, analogy, down here in the subjective mind, is that where the adjuster is? No. It's up here in the objective domain. It's in the temple. It's in the heart. And it fills the whole heart. Those three levels of the three cosmic intuitions are up there. And now every one of those levels from corner to corner, no matter how big the, you know, it doesn't have to be a huge capacity, but whatever the capacity is up there, you know, the adjuster fills it. And so if you engage the harmony point of that adjuster, you can begin to have a wholehearted phenomenon. You won't just have this little thin thread up through the, you know, when you look through that little window up in the neck of the hourglass and you see the little light shining through it, you know, and you have a little desire to follow that light, you know, and to do the Father's will. You're going beyond just the consecration of your will to the Father's will that you can see through that little hole. You're getting up there into the temple. You're engaging an objective, harmonious mind that you've constructed up there. And so you have the dual consecration. The consecration of mind to the perfect harmony of God the Mother. That's the wholeheartedness. And the consecration of your will to the Father's will. You've got the whole picture happening. Okay. So that's what they're getting at, you know, is to see how specifically how the adjuster takes all three of these things to a whole new level. It's just not possible without an adjuster.
So that line describes two phenomena.
Yeah.
Wholehearted desire
to do
the Father's will.
Yeah.
Two phenomena.
You know, you got the doing as well as the being. One must, do something as well as be something. It's just all there. Just, you know, let the whole picture just be right in front of you. You see, it's talking about harmony. You know, if you're a true personality, you're a harmonizing phenomenon. Remember, even when they talk about senses of time, you know, they talk about a mindal, a spiritual, and a personal sense. You know, a sense of sequence. A sense of sequence, because there's a motion, an ing phenomenon, you know, the mindal sense, progressing. You follow that sequence of progressive steps. Perfecting. You're following the sequence of of perfecting steps. Harmonizing. Okay. So personality sense of time is above even the perfecting sense that you have in perfecting spirit. You know, bringing it all together in a sequence of greater steps of harmony. And what do we call those when we talk about moving up levels of that? Cosmic levels, psychic circles. Right. Remember, the psychic circles are cosmic levels. They're not spirit levels. Not just about sequences along the perfecting spirit line. You know, there, it's a sequence along the harmonizing cosmic character line.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Before we go on with Jeanette, what she said.
Yeah.
That was so awesome, what your husband said, because today I was reading, I picked up the Bible and I was looking at the last page of Revelation, and where it talks about, that is the back cover. If you add to anything or take away from anything. So it right there puts fear in the person's, the biblical, the Bible. They're all afraid now. They can't go anywhere because they have to be locked in this little cage. So he was right on. I mean,
but Pam, it also begs the question, does that phrase refer, that sentence refer to the whole Bible or just that last book?
Right. All that aside, you know, there's an obvious high measure of personal responsibility that comes into play. The moment that you step beyond what some authority figure has given you to just follow, and they may have done that with the greatest sincerity and everything. They weren't trying to lead you astray. They were trying to help you, the little child of God. You know, if you're going to step to the page after the end of the Bible, that page has to be written in your heart. You have to have the ability to objectively discern a true page from a false page, because you have, you know, inner creativity. You have control. You can create false pages that fit perfectly with all the pages that you've already read. How can you tell? Subjectively, you can't. With your subjective mind, it will be a perfect next page. But if you've taken delight in cultivating a relationship with the three cosmic intuitions, the insight to see if the page is hollow or filled, you know, that insight to see if it's a true page or not, then you can boldly take that next step. It's like I've given it my full objective scrutiny, and it stands up to rigorous testing. My logical acumen, my moral discrimination, my spiritual insight, this is a true page, and I stand on it. And those who haven't discovered that will howl. You know, you can't take that next step. You know, how do you think that you can do that? Where does it say that in the book?
Exactly. I've read the whole thing.
Okay. Yeah. You know, it's just like, it's a parable of the talents. You know, Jesus tried to teach us as a parable of the talents. You know, the whole point is to take the initiation that you're given and objectively take the next step. But objectively take the next. That's the key. You have to discover, here it is, I discovered it. Then I have to recognize it. I have to have that objective step. Then I interpret it. And then I choose the next page. But if I skip the recognition step, if I just discover, interpret, and choose, zero probability that you're choosing a true page. You'll be adding a false page. I mean, they told you that even when you're actively working on creating a true next page, you're struggling with your finite consciousness for it to not be more distortion of meaning, just less. So, you know, it can have a measure of relative truth. You're not trying to create an absolute next page. That's impossible. You can only create a relative page. But it can be relatively true. If you've challenged yourself to to recognize the truth in here. If you're following a flow in here and not just reading words and interpreting them, if you're following a flow, you can take a true next step. But never assume that all your steps are true. As soon as you put something forward, don't immediately choose. Go at it. Try to break it. Put that hypothetical next page to the test. Can you refute it? Use your best abilities to take everything in the book and go throw at it and see if it'll stand up. Do all threads of truth flow through it? And if it really seems, okay, now maybe at least take a tentative step on it and see if it's like, well, okay, if I take that step, what does it imply? And if you can already see that the next thing it implies is getting shaky, oh, you better immediately drop back, reassess it. Oh, I missed that. There's a falsehood that flows through this. I see it now. Out it goes. Okay, let me try to make a true page here. Let me try again.
Rebar.
Yeah. All right. All right.
The existence of God can never be proved by scientific experiment or by the pure reason of logical deduction. God can be realized only in the realms of human experience. Nevertheless, the true concept of the reality of God is reasonable to logic, plausible to philosophy, essential to religion, and indispensable to any hope of personality survival.
And that one, just use one little quick, little bit of, just basic logic. Okay, the true concept of the reality of God is reasonable to logic. Okay, flip it around. So if your concept of God is not reasonable to logic, then it's not a true concept of God. Okay, there basically are no concepts of God on the planet right now that are reasonable to logic. That's because they are not true concepts of God. They are concepts of God, some of them with vast rationalization schemes attached to them. They're reasonable to my second adjutant. I can understand this whole vast rationalization that generations have constructed, and it's a complete lifestyle solution, and I can bond to it, and I can apply my zeal to it and believe it. But just one simple little reflective objective assessment, like, well, that's not reasonable to logic, therefore that's not a true concept of God, no matter how extensive the rationalization scheme is, no matter how many generations of the smartest people that have lived have gone into constructing it. The king has no clothes on. The little child can see that. Okay? Allow that to happen. It's the most important thing that the revelators are trying to get started, because that's the first step to anything else. Over and over again, they challenge you to take delight in cultivating a relationship with the insight that can just see that the king has no clothes on, doesn't need to spend any time memorizing all 5,000, treatises that have been generated over the last 2,000 years. That's not going to do it. Don't throw your pearls before swine. Find something better, And why do I spend most of my waking hours engaging this? Because it is reasonable to logic. It stands up beyond your wildest imaginations. Okay. You can't break it. As a matter of fact, when you try to break it, you end up discovering just how incredibly powerful the assumptions that they're giving you are. It's like if you assume what's in here, suddenly you can understand all kinds of things that no one has ever been able to understand. And that leads to the next thing. And all of a sudden, this is what truth feels like. I'm moving now. The Chris that sat here a week ago is long gone. The things I've done in the last week are huge. Every week, it just, I'm moving forward rapidly. And that, You know, that, so just, you know, and how did I get there? It's because, you know, the very first thought I had when I picked up the book was, I dare you to be logical. Because there is no other book written by religionist or scientist that will stand up to that challenge. None of them are logical. Yeah. No physics treatise can stand up to that. It's often, you know, insanely rational. You know, you may not even be smart enough to follow it. You know, the mathematics is so deep. But it's not logical. The initial assumptions are obviously false. So it doesn't matter how much calculus and group theory or whatnot that they throw into it. You know, it's not worth following.
The Emperor's Latest Centerfold.
So just, you know, you've seen me do this a lot. You know, look for those sentences where you can, you know, flip them. You know, negate both of them. You know, flip them. Okay.
Those who know God have experienced the fact of His presence. Such God-knowing mortals hold in their personal experience the only positive proof of the existence of the living God which one human being can offer to another. The existence of God is utterly beyond all possibility of demonstration, except for the contact between the God consciousness of the human mind and the God presence of the thought adjuster that indwells the mortal intellect and is bestowed upon man as the free gift of the Universal Father.
Just another simple one. Those who know God have experienced the fact of His presence. If you haven't experienced the fact of His presence, okay, you don't know God. You might know about God. Okay, it's not totally, you know, hopeless. Okay, but we're trying to take it to the next notch. We're trying to do more than just know about God. We're trying to develop a relationship, not where we think we're, you know, having, you know, daily conversations with a thought adjuster. That's not the knowing we're talking about here. But you know it because there's a new dynamic that begins to happen. Without the slightest sense of any sort of, you know, conscious recognition of the presence of the adjuster. But like they're just saying up here, you know, the presence of the divine adjuster in the human mind is disclosed. You know, none of those three things where you hear His voice every day, you know. That was none of those three things. Okay? There's a quality and a literalness, a tangibility, a power to it that just, you know, when you think about it logically, you know, just wouldn't be there unless there was something literal that was intimately involved in what's going on in your life. You aren't just, you know, oh, look at the pretty light, and you're following, you know, go towards the light. And we all know the bug zapper thing, you know, right? The bug's life. You know, you're not in that mode anymore where you're just going towards the pretty light. You know, it's like you feel spirit gravity. You know, it just feels more literal than it felt before. And it's not something that's going to just change overnight. Because you have to develop this, you have to supply the favorable conditions for your capacity to grow enough where it actually, there's enough there that it's even vaguely, indirectly sensible, you know, recognizable, you know, as a difference.
So the thought adjuster can fit those concepts into your mind.
Right. You know, you just start to feel, it's like, I've got, you know, that you, when once you can get some of these huger concepts in your mind, they don't just feel like you've stretched your earlier concepts thinner and wider. They feel not only broader, but thicker, more solid, and just, you know, a lot more tangible. And you can really feel like, oh, I can build on that. Immediately, you can feel how you can build on it. It's like, well, this is just a tissue paper. I can't put anything on that. You know, initially, things feel pretty tenuous. But the more you get into it, the more you know, it's like, okay, I'm sure that I'm not a creator being, and I couldn't create something that solid in my consciousness. There must be something that's catalyzing that degree of solidity that's going on in there now. You know, and I didn't used to have that, and now I have that. When you start to feel that, that's when you you're getting in this mode where, the adjuster is beginning to move from being a thought changer to an actual thought adjuster. The first thing it's trying to do is just change your thoughts, get you into a mode where there's actually adjustability potential, You're not born with that. You have to take delight in cultivating that.
When you say, and I've read that many times, supply the favorable condition, that would be a nice outline to see and to have, because it's, that's true. We have to do the work.
Yeah, and it's just, it's,
time, so it, work on.
You know, he brought up the Beatitudes, see, and it's that kind of, those who are not poor in spirit think they can cause growth. Those who are poor in spirit, who are humble, know that there's no such thing possible. They're not a creator being. What they need to do is to let go of this notion that the self needs to be asserted, that incessant clamoring needs to be catered to. That incessant clamoring needs to be shushed, because the initial voice is a still small voice, and it can't be heard. You can't get an initial sense of what harmony feels like in the midst of the cacophony of your subjective adjutant self. So you need to tell the little child, shh, don't do anything for a while. Just be quiet, and listen. Very patiently listen. That's the favorable conditions, humility and patience, more than anything else. And then once you have the humility and the patience, you can begin to discover reflection. And that's where the rubber meets the road in the favorable conditions. In that Take Delight in Cultivating section, they tell you there's only one thing that you have to do. There's only one favorable condition that you fundamentally need to supply. You have to put your mind into a reflective state of consciousness. Not a rationalizing state. Not a real thinking kind of, subjective thinking kind of state. Not even a meditative state. That's the being something counterpart to reflection. Reflection is doing something. Reflection is an active state where the cosmos is clearly in view over here. It's coming in through the temple where your personality stands, and it's being fed over to the subjective self here. You have a reflective linkage going on. You're comparing the two, and you're remolding the self to match what you see in the harmony of the cosmos. And it's much easier to see the harmony of cosmos when you have an adjuster in there, a point of harmony, literally in front of your face, rather than having to get, a capacity up where you have a field of view that's big enough to begin to see enough of the cosmos to really start to get a sense of harmony. That whole infinite field of view is brought right into your mind by the adjuster. So there's no limit to, now instead of extent, you need intent. You're not going to see the full infinity of the adjuster initially either. But with even the limited extent of view that you initially have, you can still take delight in cultivating greater insight to be able to penetrate more of the depth of the harmony of the adjuster. So you can do that. That's what you want. And so that's just incredibly good news. That's the good news of Pentecost, that you don't have to have a divine counselor sort of extent, a breadth of vision in order to get the big picture. Just take delight in cultivating greater insight, and the adjuster is right there. And the Spirit of Truth is fostering that linkage to the adjuster. All right.
In theory, you may think of God as the creator, and he is the personal creator of paradise and the central universe of perfection. But the universes of time and space are all created and organized by the paradise core of the creator sons. The Universal Father is not the personal creator of the local universe of Nevadon. The universe in which you live is the creation of his son Michael. Though the Father does not personally create the evolutionary universes, he does control them in many of their universal relationships and in certain of their manifestations of physical, mental, and spiritual energies. God the Father is the personal creator of the paradise universe and, in association with the eternal Son, the creator of all other personal universe creators.
Okay. All right, so the first thing, just use this opportunity to drill this home again. You know, we're obviously talking about the facet of the Father, called the Universal Creator here. And there's two different modes of relationship to the Eternal Son in this when they're functioning in this creator mode. Okay, when we talked about this, was it just last week or, you know, recently, that so you have the Universal Creator. And when the Universal Creator is bringing about Havona, I mean the Third Source Center and Havona, and it's doing that with the Second Source Center, with the Eternal Son. The Universal Creator is working with the Eternal Son, but we don't want to call him the Eternal Son. We want to talk, you know, there's got to be a creator pair. And there's two different names, creator names, for the Second Source Center. One is co-creator and one is coordinate creator. When it's in this mode, we're talking about the Universal Creator bringing about the Third Source and Center and Havona. This is the co-creator. You call the Eternal Son the co-creator. So that's the one mode that they're talking about here. Universal Creator, co-creator, giving rise to Havona. The last thing there, see, the creator of other personal universe creators, creator sons, when it's in that mode, now it's much more a father-mother sort of a mode. I mean, that creator-son has two parents. Okay, one is the universal creator, and the other is the coordinate creator, the eternal mother-son. Remember, coordinate is a mother word. Okay, so just when you see, be looking for that and be able to express it. Know what those designations mean. They give you those two. They want you to discover how to properly apply them. Oh, this is now we're talking about the co-creator. Now we're talking about the coordinate creator, both working with the universal creator. And this is the only direct creating that the universal creator does, that the Father does. Those two things. Everything else, all the other creating, is delegated, yeah. Okay, so we're talking about the Universal Creator, but we have something curiously thrown in the middle here. Though the Father does not personally create the evolutionary universes, he does control them in many of their universal relationships. Control, universal. Okay. So, now, here's the universal control, our facet. It's in the fifth functional level of total deity, the evolutional level. Okay? Though the Father does not personally create the evolutionary universes, okay, we're in the fifth functional level, the evolutional level. Even though the universal creator is not in that level, universal creator is over here, there is something of the Father that's in the evolutional level. What is it? He does control them in many of their universal relationships. The universal controller is in the evolutional domain, okay? Just notice how they've constructed. They're just, they're trying to get you to have enough of a nose ring to lead you through these paragraphs and just see the sequence, okay? So
that term universal controller is just a name to me.
Initially, it is just a name.
Right.
The challenge is to allow it to be a name that you are then try to figure out, okay, now where does this fit into the logical picture? Just let it be in your consciousness and be looking for where to properly apply it. The easiest place to start is, you know, in understanding the seven absolutes of infinity from the individuality viewpoint, something has to bring the Isle of Paradise into existence. It has to be a non-personal phenomenon. I have the unqualified absolute, this reservoir out of which I'm going to make matter. I'm going to make one absolute actualization of that potential for matter. The Isle of Paradise is going to come out of that reservoir of potential. Okay, now for that thing to come into existence, everything has to come into existence via a relationship. It doesn't just self-actualize out of the unqualified absolute. The Isle of Paradise must be the literal expression of a relationship, the relationship between the unqualified absolute and the first source and center. And the moment that you actualize that relationship as the Isle of Paradise, there's a face of the Father that's facing that, the universal controller. Just like as soon as you actualize the absolute spirit of the eternal Son out of the deity absolute reservoir, first source and center, deity absolute relationship is that absolute spirit. As soon as you have the eternal Son, you have the universal Father face. So that's the easiest way to begin to see how it fits in. And that's why, you know, when you want to put down the sevenfold creators and controllers in a precise way, okay, here's the universal Father above the eternal Son. What's above the Isle of Paradise? It's not the universal Father, it's the universal controller. You know, and if you look up in, you know, in the Almighty Supreme Paper, you know, that's why they throw in there, they give you the universal Father so you kind of know what they're talking about, but the first thing they say is the source of paradise. Okay. The source of paradise is the universal controller. That infinite reality that could create the center of infinity. Okay? All right, so universal creator, we saw them seeding the universal controller cleverly between the lines in the middle of the paragraph, and then you start reading the next paragraph and you see,
as a physical controller in the material universe of universes, the first source and center functions in the patterns of the eternal Isle of Paradise. And through this absolute gravity center, the eternal God exercises cosmic overcontrol of the physical level equally in the central universe and throughout the universe of universes. As mind, God functions in the deity of the infinite spirit. As spirit, God is manifest in the person of the eternal Son, and in the persons of the divine children of the eternal Son. This interrelation of the first source and center with the coordinate persons and absolutes of paradise does not in the least preclude the direct personal action of the universal Father throughout all creation and on all levels thereof. Through the presence of his fragmentized spirit, the Creator Father maintains immediate contact with his creature children and his created universes.
Okay, a couple things in there. One, notice how they're invoking, you know, we got the seven absolutes of infinity pictures coming in, that you have the absolute spirit, the absolute of matter, and the absolute mind. You've got those three absolute points. All three of them have a circuit. You know, there's a spirit circuit that encircuited through and from the absolute spirit. You know, another name for the eternal Son. You have, you know, that physical gravity circuit, material gravity circuit, circuited through the absolute of matter. And the absolute mind of the conjoined actor. You have the mind circuit. There's that. And, you know, when we talk about the seven absolutes infinity, there's three of those absolute, there's the three absolute actuals. And we always talk about, then there's the absolute of absolutes behind those three absolutes. And they're, you know, that's what they just alluded to, that behind each of those is the absolute of absolutes, the Father. But there's also direct. The universal Father has a personality circuit. Yeah. The universal Father is the volitional absolute. Yeah. The anchor point and the point through which that personality circuit flows. So that's all kind of reinforcing You know, this basic recognition of the seven absolutes infinity and the circuits and the absolute anchor points for those circuits. You know, all in the context of, you know, you have three different things. You have spirit things and mind things and material things and the circuits, and you even have personal things and a circuit for it. So you can kind of, you know, expand it. When you start talking about physical controller, they're immediately trying to give you, well, you know, think of the whole picture. Not, you know, it's a threefold actuality. Not just a material actuality. But then look what they throw in. Though the presence of his fragmentized spirit, oh, now we're moving on. Huh. So I had one paragraph. First, think of him as a creator. And embedded in that paragraph, it seeds controller. And then a second paragraph that says, then is a controller, and seeded in that paragraph, yeah, infinite upholder. I'll bet I know what the next paragraph is going to be. Matter of fact, it's the next section. Look at that. God is a universal spirit. You see what they did? First they came as a creator, then as a controller, and lastly as an infinite upholder. They have it in order. And they interleave them, you know. They foreshadow the next paragraph and the previous paragraph. They're trying to get you to follow that, you know, that second sentence in the paper, you know, and begin to see this, you know, and then we go, oh, and we recognize at the end of this section and at the beginning of the section they gave us those. See, they gave us those three things too. There's a lot, see, in this section that goes beyond what you can initially recognize as a new reader. It's there to help seed this following the truth, this growth, that when you start to try to understand what's going on up there in deity and reality, and you finally start putting together all the facets of the Father and this stuff, you know, you begin to notice how the whole book is constructed to sort of foster this growth. You know, in the midst of kind of reminding you of the first step of understanding with the seven absolutes of infinity, they're trying to get you into the deity, you know, the unity viewpoint at the same time. You know, where you start talking about the universal creator and the universal controller and the infinite upholder. None of those three words were used when I was talking about the seven absolutes of infinity. Right. Someone want to give us a little bit here of this next one? We won't have to unravel this one quite as much. It's a little more straightforward. You want to hear it? Just get in closer. Yeah. But we got to at least see, you know, how they do the third step here.
God is a universal spirit. God is spirit. He is a universal spiritual presence. The universal Father is an infinite spiritual reality. He is the sovereign, eternal, immortal, invisible, and only true God. Even though you are the offspring of God, you ought not to think that the Father is like yourselves in form and physique, because you are said to be created in his image, indwelt by mystery monitors dispatched from the central abode of his eternal presence. Spirit beings are real, notwithstanding they are invisible to human eyes, even though they have not flesh and blood.
Just notice the obvious. Coincidentally, the paragraph got constructed so that you ended up having to say something about thought adjusters, fragments of the infinite upholder, you know, the sense in which God is not the universal spirit, but a universal spirit. So there it is. It's this universal creator, universal controller, infinite upholder. They want you to recognize the sequence of those three paragraphs. First, think of him as a creator, then as a controller, and lastly, as an infinite upholder. And they're bringing in lots of Bible passages, like that little chunk from 1 Timothy there. Even though you are the offspring of God, before that, where were they? Wait a minute. Let's see.
The offspring of God.
It's this part here. He is the sovereign, eternal, immortal, invisible, and only true God. That's the part. It's like, I know there was a long one in there somewhere. Where was it? That's from 1 Timothy. Okay. You know, plus, you know, other things that they're picking up out of the Bible there, obviously, like in his image and stuff, you know. Okay, so, but you see what they're doing, you know, they're taking that line from the Gospel of John, God is spirit, and they're putting it in a, you know, a very different context now. I mean, instead of just some sort of monotheistic notion of God, kind of anthropomorphic, and we just say God is spirit, they've literally tied it directly to the infinite upholder. Okay? That's the context that they're wanting you to recognize a greater truth to that sentence. You know, technically, in what way is the Father spirit? Is God the Father spirit? Okay. You know, and it's not really technically as the universal Father or the universal Creator or the universal Controller. I mean, the technical way is as the infinite upholder.
Said the seer of old, "Lo, he goes by me, and I see him not. He passes on also, but I perceive him not." We may constantly observe the works of God. We may be highly conscious of the material evidences of his majestic conduct. But rarely may we gaze upon the visible manifestation of his divinity, not even to behold the presence of his delegated spirit of human indwelling.
Okay, you've got. Did everyone notice the pun in there? Does the divine counselor not have a sense of humor? So, I see him not, said the seer. He couldn't resist. He just, you know, he could have used a different word besides seer, but he just couldn't resist. It was just too, too perfect. I see him not, said the seer. That quote is from Job. You know, that's from the book of Job. So the seer here, you know, we're talking about those, you know, in Mesopotamia there, you know, the roots of the book of Job, you know, really in pre, you know, sort of official Hebrew times, you know, going back into its roots and, you know, of all that philosophy in Mesopotamia. But anyway, yep, so that's just one was too funny. All right, go ahead.
The universal Father is not invisible because he is hiding himself away from the lowly creatures of materialistic handicaps and limited spiritual endowments. The situation rather is, you cannot see my face, for no mortal can see me and live. No material man could behold the spirit God and preserve his mortal existence. The glory and the spiritual brilliance of the divine personality presence is impossible of approach by the lower groups of spirit beings or by any order of material personalities. The spiritual luminosity of the Father's personal presence is a light which no mortal man can approach, which no material creature has seen or can see. But it is not necessary to see God with the eyes of the flesh in order to discern him by the faith vision of the spiritualized mind.
That last extended quote is 1 Timothy again, so they're really pulling from 1 Timothy. Now, I mean, you know, you notice he kind of couldn't resist being just a tad sarcastic too at the beginning there. The universal Father is not invisible because he is hiding himself from the lowly creatures of materialistic handicaps and limited spiritual endowments. Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, I think he just answered the question, didn't he?
They're not already humble. They're kind of giving us a little
trigger. You know, is it not self-evident why you can't see? All those of you lowly creatures of materialistic handicaps and limited spiritual endowments. Again, you know, the basic thing in play there is the capacity. We start out as little children. The capacity is just too small even to have any sort of vague solidity to a notion of the presence of the adjuster, let alone, you know, any sort of seeing of the Father.
Yeah. I can't resist saying this. This is like an insult from Monty Python, The Life of Brian, or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You lowly creature.
Right, right. You got to notice. I mean, you know, he's a divine counselor. Remember that. You know, why did the divine counselor write these papers? Because of all those really high beings who can say they've stood in the presence of the Father many times, he can really relate to us where we are. He gets our level of thinking, and so, you know, he's engaging you like he's just one of us. You know, throwing puns out and, you know, going, duh, you know. You know, you say, I wonder why I can't see the Father. And he's going, duh. You know, okay. Just notice that. You know, let it have that frivolity in there so that, you know, you don't get to thinking too stuffy about all this, you know. And it's, you know, he wants you to be at ease and to engage this in a natural way.
Yeah, don't just unpack it. Unstuff it.
Unstuffy it.
What keeps you going on after an hour of looking at it?
Now, the one thing that I want to bring out here, okay, I mean, you know, they're bringing out, you know, like the whole thing with Moses, you know, about you cannot see my face, you know, and that sort of stuff. We've talked about this some. Let's just emphasize it again here. I mean, the whole notion, if I were to take myself as a material being, a corporeal individual, and plant myself in the immediate presence of the universal Father on paradise, you know, well how could that, you know, hurt me? Wouldn't it just be this perfect spirit luminosity that wouldn't have any impact on my matter? No. Remember, the Father is a fact that's prior to the spirit and the energy separation. There's just as much energy in the sense that we think of energy as there is spirit. Never mind that it's spiritual energy, but just in a simplistic sense, you can't get just passive spirit light out of the Father. You get just as much wattage at the same time. Okay? So you plant yourself there and, you know, you vaporize in the presence of the Father. Okay? You have to get to the, you have to, you know, go a long ways to be a fact that can stand there and not be vaporized in front of that, you know, arc lamp of God. Okay?
I was thinking, do you think that maybe, too, you know, that fact is, you made obvious, you know, just the material fact, but just the personality. See, we live with an impersonal spirit presence of the Father. When you face him, that's not impersonal. Mm-hmm. That's like full wattage personal.
Right, there's that,
and too. It's just like there's no way your personality can stay, I mean, you know, sometimes when I get into this and I'm, you know, I have to take a break because it's like, well, you know, I have to remember what I am, you know, because you can get so caught up in it to where your eye just dissolves. Right. And that's not the purpose. Right. It's to maintain the eye and still grow.
And think about what we were just saying, you know, those 3 points about the personality, the harmony.
Yeah.
Okay. What is that harmony differential? I mean, in order to engage this point of infinite harmony, I mean, and not just, you know, be blown away by it, you have to somehow have a harmonizing, you know, motion, a personal character that can strike step with this infinite harmony, you know, not just be chewed up by it, you know. So, I mean, you can come at it in all kinds of analogies to understand why you can't just throw yourself into this giant rotor blade, okay? You know,
we are the chum of the universe. Thank you for these analogies.
But
it's so personalized.
I know. But see, that's all, you know, flip forward in the book. And you know, what are the last sections in this paper? It's all about the personality. We aren't there yet. See, before they get to the personality part, which they know someone who loves spirit consciousness, it's like, where's the personality? I don't care about all this reality stuff. Huh? You know, it's like, no, before we get to there, you need to understand the rest of the picture. You know, he's more than just a personality point. He's an infinite reality. And reality is a motion. It's dynamic. He's an infinite power. And you have to think logically about this. And the reason I wanted to bring this all up is not because we love this thought experiment of putting ourselves on paradise ahead of our time. You don't have to go to paradise. What happened? A fragment of paradise came to you and is in your mind. So flip it around. Right now, as an immature, not very much harmony, not much perfecting, you know, how close do you want to get to the tip of that glowing rod of the adjuster in your mind? Do you want to really, you know, try to, you know, sever all your tethers, you know, and fling yourself right up into intimate contact with that adjuster right now? No, you don't. It'll burn out your mind. You can't get intimate with your adjuster instantly. You can only get intimate with your adjuster when you've grown up to being a first circler. You put a seven circler in intimate contact with the adjuster, and the seven circler burns out. You'll be a blithering idiot, you know, with a straitjacket on in a, you know, in an insane asylum. It'll just totally fry all your mindal circuitry. You can't handle that much truth. You know, feel like another reference. Because the eternal truth. Yeah, you know, we got that up front. Yeah. You can't handle that. And so that's why, again, patience. You have to be patient and humble. You're not ready to be a first circle yet. You may have all the desire in the world, but there's a fact in the way. The fact that God is not all those things in the second paragraph, all those wishful thinking things. God is a literal energy fact in your mind coming right straight down from infinity, stuck in your mind. You need to be very patient and grow very methodically up to the point where you can wrap yourself intimately as a first circler around that adjuster, the circumference of that adjuster. Safely.
Not dangerously.
Okay. So that's why this is in here. That's, you know, the reason this is in here, you know, is in the context, you know, they're talking about the infinite upholder, all about the thought adjuster. You know, that's what we're doing here. So don't go, well, there's a weird paragraph in here that just goes totally off topic. No, it's not off topic. It's somehow talking about your relationship with the adjuster. Ask yourself, what is the reason for this paragraph in here? You know, it's what we've talked about many times. You have this incredible, just as much pure energy as pure spirit fragment in your mind. Approach with caution and care. It loves you infinitely, you know, wants you to draw near. But when someone wanted Jesus to take steps ahead of time, what did he say? No, my hour is not yet come. Your hour is not yet come to grab directly hold of the adjuster. Recognize that, just like Jesus did. It will come in due time. You know, impatience leads down paths you don't want to go down. You know, Lucifer wanted to hold things ahead of his time. Okay, impatience is the beginning of fall. You know, the best you can hope would come out of impatience is the self-righteous impatience of default. You know, Adam and Eve. But you'll be lucky if it stops there. There's a tendency for that spirit to keep carrying you all the way to self-righteous deceit and rebellion. So impatience, you know, is a very dangerous thing.
Last week you were saying we could reach to seeing the Father now, something like that. What did you mean by that?
I can always take delight in cultivating greater insight with my third cosmic intuition, to not only see the Father afar, you know, through the personality circuit, but to see the Father within. But I'm not going to actually walk up and try to grab it. I'm just going to get a better and better, you know, microscope to see it from afar in my mind, and a better and better telescope to see it from afar without. You know, that's what that insight is. Right, you seeing that face, you know, definitely you can begin to see that, you know, quote unquote, see that face of God without, see your personal linkage in the Father's personality circuit. Begin to see the face of the Father, you know that God is, you know, is your spiritual Father through that insight. See that face of the Father from afar. And then these three points they were just talking about is what you're starting to see within. Not so much the personality, but a lot more of the reality. You begin to see that there's a catalyst within you. You know, you're not seeing a personal face. You know, it's more seeing the hands of the Father working within you. Now, when you're seeing that adjuster, because the adjuster is the Father's hand, not the Father's face.
We could try to picture the face of Michael, though, first.
You know, and that's a very, right now, that's an immediately understandable thing. Because there, you can't directly, you haven't gotten yourself up to third circler, let's say. Let's just assume for argument's sake. That, you know, that you and I haven't gotten ourselves up to third circler yet, and so we don't need the intermediary of the Spirit of Truth to link us to the adjuster. You know, we're down here in a lower level, cosmic level. We need the Spirit of Truth, Spirit of Unification, to bridge that gap between where I am and where the adjuster is. So as I try to look towards the adjuster, I have to look through the Spirit of Truth. I see the hand of Michael before I see the hand of the Father. You know, and if I can expand that with my personality eyes, I can see it's not just an energy ministry, this Spirit of Truth. It's a personal spiritual ministry of the Master's Son. So within that hand of Michael, the Spirit of Truth, I can begin to see the face of Michael. I can begin to see the personality of Michael engaging me and working with me. In the same way that the more I can begin to recognize this hand of the Father, that's going to leverage, just like they're saying here, it's going to leverage your ability to see the face of the Father personally. Yeah, so just think of it building like that.
I did look it up, and it does say that we'll come face-to-face figuratively with the Father, yeah. Not literally.
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, there's the three are at the center of paradise. You know, Father's within, surrounded by the Son, surrounded by the Spirit. You know, so there's sort of just an immutable buffer there. But see, what you will have developed is the insight, so that when you stand there, you don't just see the Spirit encased around. You can't see anything inside. You'll be able to see all three simultaneously because you'll have the insight to see, you know, to penetrate through the Infinite Spirit, through the Son, to see the Father within. I mean, that's what you developed in going through the Havona circuits. First, you got the ability to see the Spirit. And then the next circuit, you got the ability, the insight to see the Son. And then the next circuit, you got the insight to see the Father within. So when you eventually get to paradise, you can see all three simultaneously. Even though there's a lot of, you know, literalness to the concentric circle presence, you know, the three concentric circle presence of them in the center of paradise.
At the end of the book, they say it's up to us to begin. It's our biggest job is to create the intimate relationship with our Father Jester.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously at some point, yeah, I have to fuse. You know, you're moving towards intimacy. You know, but just don't forget about time. Your spiritual consciousness always skips the time element in those sentences. You have to let your material consciousness remind your spiritual consciousness about time. You want to be intimate with the adjuster over time. Your spiritual consciousness never adds that parenthetical to a sentence. You have to let your material consciousness add comma over time. Just like Jesus said, yeah, I'm going to do that over time. I'm not going to do it right now. You know, that's a process I'm going through. You know, I'm going to get to that point that you recognize and I recognize I need to get to, but I'm not going to do it by fiat right now. I'm going to get to it. I'm going to evolve to it over time. I'm going to follow the evolutionary hand of the mother. I'm not going to supersede her evolutionary hand and just force the Father into place. I mean, again, like I try to point out, if Michael knows that if he were to do that, he would be in rebellion. That's what Lucifer is trying to do. He's trying to skip time, skip the evolutionary process. And just, you know, I can see where this ought to go. Let's just do it now. Why spend all this, you know, all these millennia fiddling around? Let's just do it by fiat. No, you're in rebellion instantly because God the Mother is just as important as God the Father. They're equals. You know?
The Chris sitting here now and the Patrick sitting here now is different than the one a week ago. Because you see the intimacy.
Right. And
over time.
And that growth is not because I willed it into existence. I allowed the mother to grow me. To forget about the mother is to begin the path of self-deception. Lucifer. Or you think you can just will it into existence. All right, let's get a little more here. Let's see, where were we? I lost track. Let's see.
We're at the first paragraph, or the section break. So, the spirit nature of the universal Father is shared fully with his coexistent self, the eternal Son of Paradise. Both the Father and the Son, in like manner, share the universal and eternal spirit fully and unreservedly with their conjoint personality coordinate, the infinite spirit. God's spirit is, in and of himself, absolute. In the Son, it is unqualified. In the spirit, universal. And in and by all of them, infinite.
Just the one little point. In the Son, it is unqualified. They want you to begin to tease this apart and recognize that you have to think of energy and spirit together when you're talking about the first and the third source and center. In the Son, it's all just spirit because the parallel is the aisle where it's all just matter. They're not blends. It's unqualified spirit on the one hand and unqualified matter on the other hand. But they're, very exceptional in that sense. Everything else tends to be some blend. An angel is not, a pure spirit body. An angel is a blend of energy and spirit, as a body. And, everything is a blend. Because, these two things come together in the God of action, and it's from that God of action that all this manifests. So, it fundamentally has various shades of blending, as it's manifested.
God is a universal spirit. God is the universal person. The supreme personal reality of the finite creation is spirit. The ultimate reality of the personal cosmos is absonite spirit. Only the levels of infinity are absolute, and only on such levels is there finality of oneness between matter, mind, and spirit.
So clear down to the finite level, you can really think very definitively. It's all, you have spirit on one side, matter on the other side, matter on the other side, and you're trying to bring them into a harmony through mind. They're reminding you that, you go up to the absonite, and there automatically are blends. And so it isn't so simple, just matter, mind, spirit. And then you take it all the way to the absolute. And, even though conceptually you have to understand, you have to think about absolute matter and absolute spirit. Remember what we always say, when they actually get up there with a microscope and, look at the substance of the body of the Son and the substance of the aisle, and they're going, okay, I know there one is absolute spirit and one is absolute matter, but I'm just not seeing the difference. Not only can't you see the difference, but then, and the other ones, like in the Father, it isn't like you can't see the difference. They're one. They're just one innately. So that's what they're, So you have this bottom-up viewpoint relationship to this where it starts out very separate, and as you move up it, it blends together.
In the universes, God the Father is, in potential, the over-controller of matter, mind, and spirit. Only by means of his far-flung personality circuit does God deal directly with the personalities of his vast creation of will creatures. But he is contactable, outside of paradise, only in the presences of his fragmented entities, the will of God abroad in the universes. This paradise spirit that indwells the minds of the mortals of time and there fosters the evolution of the immortal soul of the surviving creature is of the nature and divinity of the universal Father. But the minds of such evolutionary creatures originate in the local universes and must gain divine perfection by achieving those experiential transformations of spiritual attainment, which are the inevitable result of a creature's choosing to do the will of the Father in heaven.
See, all the things your spiritual consciousness is recognizing, and then they say, but, and look what they're throwing in there. They're throwing in the other consecration. You know, but the minds of such evolutionary creatures originate in the local universes and must gain divine perfection by achieving those experiential transformations. Yeah. Okay, you know, that's that you have to, you know, consecrate your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. And it starts very locally with the Creative Mother Spirit. So, you know, we pointed it out. They've done it several times where they're trying to remind you that there's two consecrations. You can't just do it all with will. Yes, the will initiates the process. I mean, obviously, you're not going to expand your capacity if you don't, put that choice up front. I exercise my will to allow favorable conditions, to allow myself to be grown. I mean, you have to have the Father initiate the event. But the actual process is a mother process, not a father process. And that's what they're reminding you of there.
In the inner experience of man, mind is joined to matter. Such material-linked minds cannot survive mortal death. The technique of survival is embraced in those adjustments of the human will and those transformations in the mortal mind whereby such a God-conscious intellect gradually becomes spirit-taught and eventually spirit-led. This evolution of the human mind from matter association to spirit union results in the transmutation of the potentially spirit phases of the mortal mind into the Maurantia realities of the immortal soul. Mortal mind, subservient to matter, is destined to become increasingly material and consequentially to suffer eventual personality extinction. Mind yielded to spirit is destined to become increasingly spiritual and ultimately to achieve oneness with the surviving and guiding divine spirit, and in this way to attain survival and eternity of personality existence.
Two little things to bring out in there. There's this nice little sentence speaking to results in the transmutation of the potentially spirit phases of the mortal mind into the Maurantia realities of the immortal soul. A way to visualize that directly, we've talked about this. If you can get a measure of harmony going in your mortal mind, you know, that measure of harmony is soul-like. It's not literally your soul, but it is very much soul-like. It's so soul-like that the adjuster can make a hard copy of that, a brick of soul. Now that measure of harmony becomes a brick of soul. And so you set up this potential resonance between the two. You know, that measure of harmony is sustained by its relationship to the literalization of that harmony in the soul. So, you know, the more this grows, the more you can really get this positive feedback mechanism. We talked about that a lot when we were talking about the adjuster papers. You know, a lot of times what people have called soul is just that soul-like, you know, if you know, there's some truth to what they're saying, you know, it's just the soul-like harmony in their mind. It's not literally the soul, which is a separate fact. And that's what they're pointing to there. And then just this other technical point. You know, why, if you're, you know, you're, you know, we always say your adjutant self, your mortal self is just that mortal. Well, why? Why does my adjutant self have to be mortal? Why can't it just go on? Okay? That mind is joined to matter very directly, intimately. Okay, and matter obeys the second law of thermodynamics. It unravels so that the mind that's attached to that matter unravels. It just does. That's what it does. You can't prevent that. Jesus' mortal self unraveled because it was attached to his brain, and his brain unraveled. You know, even if he hadn't, you know, been executed, he, you know, eventually he would have just unraveled. All mortal selves die because they're attached to matter, and matter obeys the second law of thermodynamics. Okay? You know, increasing entropy, unraveling. The only way to prevent that is to attach it to spirit substance. Because unlike material substance, spirit substance doesn't obey the second law of thermodynamics. It's a unity substance, not the individuality substance. Its natural state is not parts, like the individuality substance. Its natural state is unity, spirit substance. So the more you can get, you know, you can move away from the domain where it's, you know, very much attached to the matter, and get it up there where it's more attached to the spirit, and you can get this copying process going on from that upper domain of the mind over into bricks of soul, then all the really important stuff is copied. And so when the bottom unravels, and of course the top unravels with it, you know, can step over here onto the hard copy and keep going. Yeah, it's just as simple as that.
It says somewhere in here that mind exhibits functional unity.
Right.
Where is that experienced in consciousness?
It's experienced back here when we talk about intellectual capacity. It didn't say mental capacity. It said intellectual. We've talked about this. Intellectual is very definitively used as referring to the upper domains of the mind energy system. I mean, it's mental in general, but it's intellectual specifically in the upper domains. You know, they're adjutant mind spirits. The more you move up in the mindal energy system, the closer you're getting to the spirit substance end. You know, mind is this fluid-like energy with two substances that grip it on each end. Okay? And so as you know, if you move up into those upper domains of mind, or, you know, if you have a mind that's very definitively seated on a spiritual character, or even the spirit that's in your Marantia substance, you know, spirit and matter woven together in Marantia substance, that sort of mind has much more of that unity in it as a consequence of its relationship to the unity substance. So that's what that's getting at. You know, when you think about the infinite mind of the infinite spirit, that infinite mind has a very definitive unity to it. Okay? You and I start out with a cacophony, you know, of mind more than a unity of mind, the incessant clamoring of inescapable self, those choppy seas that are much more like all the little individuations of matter. You know, so the matter, the mind has a matter-like character, has a more fragmented sort of character, individuated sort of a character. But as you move up, you'll begin to experience that unity more. That's a good kind of a feedback of what you're looking for. What's the difference between being out in the lower domains and the upper domains? You know, it's going to just have a more holistic, natural character to it when you're functioning closer to the spirit.
Yeah. It says the technique of second sentence or third sentence, mm-hmm. the technique of survival mm-hmm. is embraced in those adjustments of the human will. The will is what adjusts, and those transformations in the mortal mind. So the mind is reformed when the will makes the adjustment.
Right.
For the longest,
not my.
It's not
will,
mind that's adjusting.
Oh no! It's not my will.
Right.
That's the transformation.
Okay.
Now remember again. You have this purposing gift, but you know it doesn't automatically purpose to the right. You know, it could purpose to the wrong. You have to distinguish. You have to use your second cosmic intuition to distinguish right from wrong. So, you know, that's what you're trying to get at.
Part in the adjuster section, too, it says the personality chooses is the will's resident in the personality rather than the mind.
Right.
Yeah. And again, it's just, you know, it's a sequence. I mean, obviously, you have to use your father-likeness, the initiator, to initiate any process. You have to use that personality gift to initiate it. But then recognize that you are initiating something. You're not finishing something. Don't think of yourself as having a gift from the universal creator. You're not creating something. You're initiating something. Now you've got to follow through the whole process over time. You know? And your guidance for how to do that is not the Father. The Father is just the initiator. He's the guide of how to get it started. Who's going to guide you along the way? You know, there's the will, and then there's the way. You know, and the mother is who guides you along the way. That's that second consecration. You've got to consecrate yourself to the harmony, because it's a harmonizing sequence that was initiated. So you have to relate yourself to the harmony likeness.
I mean, a God-conscious intellect, right? That's an already God-conscious intellect. Mm-hmm. Still, is starting into something that's gradual.
Mm-hmm. Gradually and, becomes.
Yeah,
right.
They really want you to get the time part.
That's the most difficult thing that your spiritual consciousness is tripping you up with. It has no notion of time. You have to recognize that. And so you have to always inform it of time. You can't just follow its inclination. You have to inform your spiritual consciousness of time. And as soon as you start doing that, you'll start to have cosmic consciousness instead of merely spiritual consciousness and a denial of facts.
So are you in your spiritual consciousness right now, Chris?
That's a loaded question.
Yes and no. I'm not merely in my spiritual consciousness. I mean, you know how close I am to spiritual consciousness. All I have to do is just begin to think about it, and I start tearing up. You know, the power of the feeling that spiritual consciousness is capable of. You know, when I really pause and reflect on the unity that I'm engaged in. But that, you know, doesn't often come to the fore because I'm trying to help everyone with all of the details that are attached to that unity, you know, and not just try to live off the unity alone, but to begin to see it as, you know, as having two faces. But certainly my spiritual consciousness can drive me on for endless hours of, you know, of pursuit of truth. You know, that zeal in your spiritual consciousness is, you know, just never tires, you know, especially when it really knows it's following truth and not just making up stuff, you know, to keep a rationalization scheme going. I mean, you know, you can overrule your body's need for food and sleep to a high degree when you're following the truth. Okay, let's get this last paragraph in here. Yep.
I come forth from the eternal, and I have repeatedly returned to the presence of the Universal Father. I know of the actuality and personality of the first source and center, the Eternal and Universal Father. I know that, while the great God is absolute, eternal, and infinite, he is also good, divine, and gracious. I know the truth of the great declarations, God is Spirit and God is Love. And these two attributes are most completely revealed to the universe in the Eternal Son.
Okay, God is Spirit and God is Love. John and 1 John. One little thing before we pick up, you know, just comment on that. Notice, remember I pointed out when you're thinking about the facets of deity, and some of them you think of as eternal, and some like the Eternal Son. And some you think of as infinite, like the infinite polar, and the infinite ones are the reservoirs from an individuality viewpoint. And I pointed out that the ones that have universal for an adjective, you know, think of that as eternal. When you're thinking about that mode, are they a reservoir or not? You know, it's the eternal Isle of Paradise, it's not a reservoir. Universal, so you go, well, what about the Universal Father? Is that a reservoir or not? Well, see, you know, it's the eternal. See how they're, you know, eternal and universal Father? They're even giving you that hint about thinking about the words eternal and universal, you know, in relationship there, so that you can distinguish between whether or not you would want to capitalize the word infinite and put it in a proper designation or capitalize the word eternal and put it in a proper designation. You know, you wouldn't want to capitalize the word infinite in talking about the Father. I mean, yeah, he's an infinite fact, but you wouldn't want to put that as a proper designation, you know, the infinite Father, capital I. But you could call it the eternal Father, capital E.
Would it be, if you've got eternal as more, if the infinite is the capacity or the reservoir, mm-hmm. And eternal is less so, would universal universal is more like eternal and permeating the reservoir.
Well, you could kind of see the space and time. See, when you actually make it infinite and eternal, and think about the, you know, is it more of an infinite thing or an eternal thing? Is it more of a space-like thing or a time-like thing? I mean, even, you know, you talk about the infinite upholder. That's part of bringing all the, you know, the hierarchy of God the Mother, the absolute upholder, the absentite upholder, and the finite upholder into existence. And yeah, so, you know, and she's female's place, you know, male's direction. And there's all these things that you can begin to reflect on. You know, but just that right there, I mean, it's universal because it's eternal more than it's infinite. You know, it's not so much universal because it's infinite. It's universal because it's eternal. Just that's what they want you to reflect on. But then the last little thing, you know, before we leave. Look how they leave you as a poor, innocent little new reader, and you're just trying to expand your thinking beyond the Father and bringing in some other things. And you have a lot of these really rock-solid things about that you've attached to the Father, like God is Spirit in the Gospel of John and God is Love in the first, you know, Epistle of John. And what do they do to you? Look what they do to you to end that sentence. And these two attributes are most completely revealed in the universe in the eternal Son? You know, at that point you hear the LP go, you know? you know, wait a minute, stop everything. I thought I knew what was going on here. And then they threw that in right at the end. Yeah, see, that's that little challenge, you know, that they want you to be building to. So by the time you get to the papers on the Son, you're ready to deal with this distinction that the Father is the volitional absolute, but the Son is the personality absolute. And you're talking about in that, you know, as the personality absolute and love, God is, you know, love. It's in the personality block. See? They're most completely revealed as that absolute person, the Son. To allow that, to allow the Son to have that, there's probably nothing that you want to take away from the Father that's going to be more painful, sort of to your initial spiritual consciousness. That is just going to feel wrong. You can't, you know, to allow the eternal Son to be the absolute personality and have love that absolutely attached to him. As difficult as that feels, the more you can, you know, reflect on how just grating that feels to allow that transference from the Father to the Son like that. That's how much the Father was willing to divest. He could give that away, and he did. He gave away being the absolute personality. He gave away being the one for which that attribute is most completely revealed in the universe. That's how, you know, humble he is. You know, the work is important, the self is not. Okay, even to that degree. The fact that you can feel the tension there, turn it around and recognize, you know, what's going on at the source, that's what he actually gave away. What you just, you know, you may even decide when you read that the book is false and you throw it away. It's like, that's just too much for me. You know, there would be those that, you know, that could, and they're putting it right up front like that is a sort of a challenge. Because that's the fact. The eternal Son is the absolute personality. Okay, just wanted to stress that. Because it's, you know, you keep reading, it's not like they continue on that theme. It's just like thrown in there. The last words is a real non sequitur, it seems. Interesting little technique of construction there.
In the way you've mentioned earlier how they'll relate the end of this section to the start of the next one.
Yeah.
I noticed the next section is the mystery of God.
Yeah.
And as
he's catching on.
The Eternal Son is the most completely revealing those attributes.
Mm-hmm.
It right. suggests that they are mysterious or more hidden, less revealed in the Father. They're still. It's not right. like he doesn't have those aspects.
Right. But it's in a way that isn't so revealed. I mean, that's really a good way to describe it. I mean, and just one little thought to begin to appreciate that. I defined personality early on tonight as individuated will. The Universal Father is a personality, but not in the sense of individuated will. He's the reservoir of will. The personality of the Father is the unindividuated will. The unindividuatable will. You know, you can individuate a great big chunk and give it to the Eternal Son. You can individuate a great big chunk of will and give it to the, you know, the conjoint actor. You know, you can dole out little individuations to all of us and on and on and on and on. But there's a part of that reservoir of total will that's not individuatable. That unindividuated will is the Father personality. They've tried to bring that in. There's personality, but then there's a very special, there's a singular type of personality that's different than any other personality because it's unindividuated will, and it needs to be called Father personality. And that's why they introduce that term as you go forward, so that you begin to appreciate the difference. And the way that manifests relative to you is, unlike you and I engaging as point-to-point personalities, where everyone that engages you engages the same personality. There's just one personality, and it's there. That's because you're an individuation of will. The Father's singularly different. You engage the Father as a personality. There's a face that only you can see, a personality face that only you can see. And likewise for me, you'll never see my face, and I'll never see your face, because he's an infinite number of faces. He's this unindividuated will. When you individuate it, it has one face. But if it's unindividuated, it has an infinite number of faces. And hence it can, you know, each of us can engage it, the Father, as if there's absolutely no one in the universe except the Father and myself. The Father's relationship to me is absolute, like that. He's not the absolute, you know, the personality absolute. He's something even greater. See, that's what they're trying to get you to, you know, it's like, wait, you know, I think I just gave away everything. No. What you just allowed yourself to do by making the Eternal Son the personality absolute is you allowed for the recognition of something even greater than the personality absolute, the Father personality. In infinity, not in absoluteness. Okay. Yep. Let's wrap it up here. All right. Thank you, everyone, for sticking with the long haul there. We got a late start, but still, it was still a long haul. Let's take a moment to reflect here.